Les Broches. Chapter 79. The Cave. Useful herbs, I wrote, and paused, as usual, to consider. Writing with a quill caused one to be both more deliberate and more economical in writing than doing it with ballpoint or typewriter. Still, I thought, I'd best just make a list here and jot down notes regarding each herb as they came to me, then make a clean draft when I'd got it all straight, and made sure to include everything rather than try to do it all in a single run. Lavender, peppermint, comfrey, I wrote without hesitation. Calendula, feverfew, foxglove, meadowsweet. Then went back to add a large asterisk beside foxglove to remind me to add strong cautions about the use, as all parts of the plant were extremely poisonous in any but very small doses. I twiddled the quill, biting my lip in indecision. Ought it to mention that one at all, given that this was meant to be a useful medical guide for the common man, not for medical practitioners with experience in various medicaments? Because really, you ought not dose anyone with foxglove unless you've been trained. Best not. I crossed it out, but then had second thoughts. Perhaps I'd better mention it with a drawing, but also with a severe warning that it should be used only by a physician, in case someone had the bright idea of remedying Uncle Toffiger's dropsy permanently. A shadow fell across the floor in front of me, and I looked up. Jamie was standing there with a most peculiar look on his face. What? I said, startled. Has something happened? No, he said, and advancing into the study, leaned down and put his hands on the desk, bringing his face within a foot of mine. Have you ever been in the slightest doubt that I need you? He demanded. It took roughly half a second of thought to answer this. No, I replied promptly. To the best of my knowledge, you needed me urgently the moment I saw you, and I haven't any reason to think you've got any more self-sufficient since. What on earth happened to your forehead? Those look like tooth. He lunged across the desk and kissed me before I could finish the observation. Thank you, he said fervently, and, unlunging, whirled and went out, evidently in the highest of spirits. What's amiss with Uncle Jimmy? Ian demanded, coming in on Jamie's heels. He glanced back toward the open door into the hall, from the depths of which a loud, tuneless humming was coming, like that of a trapped bumblebee. Is he drunk? I don't think so, I said dubiously, running my tongue across my lips. He didn't taste of anything alcoholic. Aye, well. Ian lifted a shoulder, dismissing his uncle's eccentricities. I was just up beyond Brochmurder, and Mr. McAllister said to me that his wife's mother was taken bad in the night. And would you maybe think of coming by, if it wasn't a trouble to you? No trouble at all, I assured him, rising with alacrity. Just let me get my bag. For all it was spring, a cold, treacherous season, the tenants and neighbours seemed remarkably healthy. With some caution, I had resumed my doctoring, tentatively offering advice and medicine where it might be accepted. After all, I was no longer the Lady of Lallybroch, and many of the folk who'd known me before were now dead. Those who weren't seemed generally glad to see me, but there was a wariness in their eyes that hadn't been there before. It saddened me to see it, but I understood it all too well. I had left Lallybroch, left himself, left them. And while they affected to believe the story Jamie put about my having thought him dead and fled to France, they couldn't help but feel I'd betrayed them by going. I felt I'd betrayed them. The easiness that had once existed between us was gone, and so I didn't routinely visit as I once had. I waited to be called. And in the meantime, when I had to get out of the house, I went foraging on my own or walked with Jamie, who also had to get out of the house now and then. One day, when the weather was windy but fine, he took me farther than usual, saying that he would show me his cave if I liked. I would, very much, I said. I put my hand above my eyes to shield them from the sun as I looked up a steep hill. Is it up there?
Aye. Can you see it?
I shook my head. Aside from the big white rock the people called Leaper the Cask, it could have been any Highland hillside, clustered with gorse, broom and heather. What ground showed in between only rocks.
Come on, then, Jamie said,
and setting foot on an invisible foothold, smiled and reached a hand to help me up. It was a hard climb, and I was panting and damp with perspiration by the time he pushed aside a screen of gorse to show me the narrow mouth of the cave. I want to go in.
No, you don't, he assured her. It's cold and it's dirty.
She gave him an odd look and a half a smile. I'd never have guessed, she said, very dryly. I still want to go in. There was no point in arguing with her. He shrugged and took off his coat to save its getting filthy, hanging it on a rowan sapling that had sprouted near the entrance. He put up his hands to the stones on either side of the entrance, but then was unsure. Was it there he had always grasped the stone or not?
Christ, does it matter?
He chided himself, and taking firm hold of the rock, stepped in and swung down. It was just as cold as he'd known it would be. It was out of the wind, at least. Not a biting cold, but a dank chill that sank through the skin and gnawed at the bone ends. He turned and reached up his hands, and she leaned to him, tried to climb down, but lost her footing and half fell, landing in his arms in a fluster of clothes and loose hair. He laughed and turned her round to look, but kept his arms around her. He was loath to surrender the warmth of her and held her like a shield against cold memory. She was still, leaning back against him, only her head moving as she looked from one end of the cave to the other. It was barely 8 feet long, but the far end was lost in shadow. She lifted her chin, seeing the soft black stains that coated the rock to one side by the entrance.
That's where my fire was, when I dared have one.
His voice sounded strange, small and muffled, and he cleared his throat. Where was your bed?
Just there, by your left foot.
Did you sleep with your head at this end? She tapped her foot on the gravel dirt of the floor.
Aye, I could see the stars if the night was clear. I turned the other way if it rained.
She heard the smile in his voice and put her hand along his thigh, squeezing. I hope that, she said, her own voice a little choked. When we learned about the Dunbonnet and the cave, I thought about you, alone here, and I hoped you could see the stars at night.
I could, he whispered,
and bent his head to put his lips to her hair. The shawl she'd pulled over her head had slipped off, and her hair smelled of lemon balm, and what she said was catmint. She made a small noise in her throat, and folded her own arms over his, warming him through his shirt. I feel as though I've seen it before, she said, sounding a little surprised. Though I suppose one cave probably looks a good deal like any other cave, unless you have stalactites hanging from the ceiling or mammoths painted on the walls.
I've never had a talent for decoration, he said,
and she, again, amused.
As for being here, you've been here many nights wi' me, Sassenach. You and the wee lass both.
Though I didn't ken then she was a lassie, he added silently, remembering with a small odd pang that now and then he had sat there on the flat rock by the entrance, imagining sometimes a daughter warm in his arms, but now and then feeling a tiny sun on his knee and pointing out the stars to travel by, explaining to him how the hunting was done, and the prayer you must say when you killed for food. But he told those things to Brianna later, and to Jem. The knowledge wouldn't be lost.
Would it be of use, though? He wondered suddenly.
Do folk still hunt? He asked.
Then?
Oh, yes, she assured him. Every fall we'd have a rash of hunters coming into the hospital, mostly idiots who'd got drunk and shot each other by mistake. though once I had a gentleman who'd been badly trampled by a deer he thought was dead." He laughed, both shocked and comforted. The notion of hunting while drunken, though he'd seen fools do it, but at least men still did hunt. Jem would hunt.
"I'm sure Roger Mack wouldn't let Jem take too much drink before hunting," he said, "even if the other lads do."
Her head tilted a little to and fro in the way it did when she was wondering whether to tell him something, and he tightened his arms a little.
"What?"
"I was just imagining a gang of second graders having a tot of whiskey all round before setting off home from school in the rain," she said, snorting briefly. "Children don't drink alcohol then, at all. Or at least they aren't meant to. And it's scandalous child neglect if they're allowed."
"Aye?"
That seemed odd. He'd been given ale or beer with his food since, well, as far back as he recalled. And certainly a dram of whiskey against the cold, or if his liver were chilled, or he had the earache, or... It was true, though, that Brianna made Jem drink milk, even after he was out of smocks. The rattle of stones on the hillside below startled him, and he let go of Claire, turning toward the entrance. He doubted it was trouble, but nonetheless motioned to her to stay, hoisting himself out of the cave mouth and reaching for his coat and the knife in its pocket, even before he looked to see who had come. There was a woman some way below, a tall figure in cloak and shawl, down by the big rock where Fergus had lost his hand. She was looking up, though, and saw him come out of the cave. She waved to him and beckoned, and with a quick glance round that assured him she was alone, he made his way half-sliding down the slope to the trail where she stood.
"Fiskama,"
he greeted her, shrugging into the coat. She was fairly young, perhaps in her early 20s, but he didn't know her, or thought he didn't, until she spoke. She said formally, "How do you do, father?" He blinked, startled, but then leaned forward, peering at her.
"Junie?" he said, incredulous. "Wee Junie?"
Her long, rather solemn face broke into a smile at that, but it was brief.
"You know me, then?" "Aye, I do, now I come to see."
He put out a hand, wanting to embrace her, but she stood a bit away from him, stiff, and he let the hand drop, clearing his throat to cover the moment.
"It's been some time, lass. You've grown,"
he added lamely.
"Bairns mostly do," she said dry. "Is it your wife you've got with you? The first one, I mean?"
"It is," he replied,
the shock of her appearance replaced by wariness. He gave her a quick look over in case she might be armed, but couldn't tell. Her cloak was wrapped round her against the wind.
"Perhaps you'd summon her down," Joan suggested. "I should like to meet her."
He rather doubted that. Still, she seemed composed, and he could scarcely refuse to let her meet Claire if she wished it. Claire would be watching. He turned and gestured toward the cave, beckoning her, and then turned back to Joan.
"How'd you come to be here, lass?" he asked, turning back to her.
It was a good 8 miles to Balriggan from here, and there was nothing near the cave to draw anyone.
"I was coming to Lallybroch to see you. I missed your visit when you came to the house," she added, with a brief flash of what might have been amusement. "But I saw you and your wife walking, so I came after you."
It warmed him to think she'd wanted to see him. At the same time, he was cautious. It had been 12 years, and she'd been a child when he left. And she'd spent those years with Lyra, doubtless hearing no good opinions of him in that time. He looked searchingly into her face, seeing only the vaguest memory of the childish features he recalled. She wasn't beautiful, or even pretty, but had a certain dignity about her that was attractive. She met his gaze straight on, not seeming to care what he thought of what he saw. She had the shape of Lyra's eyes and nose, though little else from her mother, being tall, dark, and raw-boned, heavy-browed, with a long, thin face, and a mouth that wasn't much use to smiling, he thought.
He heard Claire making her way down the slope behind him and turned to help her, though keeping one eye on Joni just in case.
"Dinna fash," Joan said calmly behind him. "I dinna mean to shoot her."
"Och, well, that's good."
Discomposed, he tried to remember. Had she been in the house when Lyra shot him? He thought not, though he'd been in no condition to notice. She'd certainly known about it, though.
Claire took his hand and hopped down onto the trail, not pausing to settle herself, but coming forward at once and taking Joan's hands in both her own, smiling. "I'm happy to meet you," she said, sounding as though she meant it. "Masali said I was to give you this." And leaning forward, she kissed Joan on the cheek. For the first time, he saw the girl taken aback. She flushed and pulled her hands away, turning aside, and rubbing a fold of her cloak under her nose as though taken by an itch, lest anyone see her eyes well up.
"I thank you," she said, with a hasty dab at her eyes.
"You... my sister's written of you."
She cleared her throat and blinked hard, then stared at Claire with open interest, an interest that was being returned in full.
"Félicité looks like you," Claire said.
"So does Henri Christian, just a bit, but Félicité very much."
"Poor child," Joan murmured, but couldn't repress the smile that had lit her face at this. Jamie coughed.
"Will you not come down to the house, Junie? You'd be welcome."
She shook her head.
"Later, maybe. I wanted to speak to you, where no one could hear."
"Save your wife," she added with a glance at Claire,
"as she's doubtless something to see on the matter."
That sounded mildly sinister, but then she added,
"It's about my dowry."
"Why? Well, come away out of the wind, at least."
He led them toward the lee of the big rock, wondering what was afoot. Was the lass wanting to wed someone unsuitable, and her mother was refusing to give her her dowry? Had something happened to the money?
He doubted that. Old Ned Gowan had devised the documents, and the money was safe in a bank in Inverness.
And whatever he thought of Lyra, he was sure she'd never do anything to the hurt of her daughters. A huge gust of wind came up the track, whirling up the women's petticoats like flying leaves, and pelting them all with clouds of dust and dry heather. They darted into the shelter of the rock, and stood smiling and laughing a little with the intoxication of the weather, brushing off the dirt and settling their clothes.
"So then," Jamie said, before the good mood should have a chance to curdle on them, "who is it you mean to wed?"
"Jesus Christ," Joan replied promptly.
He stared at her for a moment until he became aware that his mouth was hanging open and closed it.
"You want to be a nun?"
Claire's brows were raised with interest.
"Really? I do. I've kent for a long time that I've a vocation, but..."
She hesitated.
"It's complicated."
"I dare say it is," Jamie said, recovering himself somewhat. "Have you spoken to anyone about it, lass? The priest? Your mother?"
Joan's lips pressed into a thin line.
"Both of them," she said shortly.
"And what did they say?" Claire asked. She was plainly fascinated, leaning back against the rock, combing back her hair with her fingers.
Joan snorted. "My mother says," she said precisely, "that I've lost my mind from reading books. And that's all your fault," she added pointedly to Jamie, "for giving me the taste for it. She wants me to wed old Geordie McCann, but I said I'd rather be dead in the ditch."
"How old is old Geordie McCann?" Claire inquired, and Joan blinked at her.
25 or so," she said. "What's that got to do with it?"
"Just curious," Claire murmured, looking entertained.
"There's a young Geordie McCann, then?"
"Aye, his nephew. He's 3,
Joan added, in the interests of strict accuracy.
"I didn't want to wed him, either."
"And the priest?" Jamie intervened before Claire could derail the discussion entirely.
Joan drew breath, seeming to grow taller and sterner with it.
"He says that it's my duty to stay him and tend to my aged mother."
"Who's swiving Dewey, the hired man, in the goat shed?" Jamie added helpfully. "You ken that, I suppose."
From the corner of his eye he saw Claire's face, which entertained him so much that he was obliged to turn away and not look at her. He lifted a hand behind his back, indicating that he'd tell her later.
"Not while I'm in the house, she doesn't," Joan said coldly, "which is the only reason I am in the house still. Do you think my conscience would let me leave knowing what they'll be up to? This is the first time I've gone further than the kale yard in 3 months, and if it wasn't as sinful to place wagers, I'd bet you my best shift they're at it this minute, damning both their souls to hell."
Jamie cleared his throat, trying, and failing, not to think of Joey and Lyra, wrapped in passionate embrace on her bed with the blue and grey quilt.
"Aye, well."
He could feel Claire's eyes boring into the back of his neck and felt the blood rise there.
"So, you want to go for a nun, but the priest says you mustn't. Your mother will na give you your dowry for it, and your conscience will na let you do it anyway. Is that the state of things, would you say?"
"Aye, it is," Joan said, pleased with his concise summary. "And, what is it that you'd like Jamie to do about it?" Claire inquired, coming round to stand by him. "Kill Joey?"
She shot Jamie a sidelong, yellow-eyed glance full of wicked enjoyment at his discomfiture. He gave her a narrow look and she grinned at him.
"Of course not."
Joan's heavy brow drew down.
"I want them to wed. Then they'd no be in a state of mortal sin every time I turn my back. And the priest couldn't see I've to stay at home, not if my mother's got a husband to care for her."
Jamie rubbed a finger slowly up and down the bridge of his nose, trying to make out just how he was meant to induce two middle-aged reprobates to wed. By force? Hold a fowling piece on them? He could, he suppose, but... Well, the more he thought of it, the better he liked the notion.
"Does he want to marry her, do you think?" Claire asked, surprising him.
It hadn't occurred to him to wonder that.
"Aye, he does," Joan said, with obvious disapproval. "He's always mooning on about it to me, how much he loves her."
She rolled her eyes.
"Not that I think he shouldn't love her," she hastened to add, seeing Jamie's expression. "But he shouldn't be telling me about it now, should he?"
No, he said, feeling mildly dazed. The wind was booming past the rock, and the whine of it in his ears was eating at him, making him feel suddenly as he used to in the cave, living in solitude for weeks, with no voice but the winds to hear. He shook his head violently to clear it, forcing himself to focus on Joan's face, hear her words above the wind.
"She's willing, I think," Joan was saying, still frowning, "though she doesna talk to me about it, thank bride. She's fond of him, though, feeds him the choice bits and that."
"Well, then."
He brushed a flying strand of hair out of his mouth, feeling dizzy.
"Why do they not marry?"
"Because of you," Claire said, sounding a trifle less amused. "And that's where I come into this, I suppose."
"Because of?"
"The agreement you made with Lyra when I came back."
Her attention was focused on Joan, but she came closer and touched his hand lightly, not looking at him. "You promised to support her and find dowries for Joan and Masali, but the support was to stop if she married again. That's it, isn't it?" she said to Joan, who nodded.
"She and Dewey might make shift to scrape along," she said. "He does what he can, but you've seen him. If you were to stop the money, though, she'd likely have to sell Balriggan to live. And that would break her heart," she added quietly, dropping her eyes for the first time.
An odd pain seized his heart. Odd because it wasn't his own, but he recognized it. It was sometime in the first weeks of their marriage when he'd been digging new beds in the garden. Lyra had brought him out a mug of cool beer and stood while he drank it, then thanked him for the digging. He'd been surprised and laughed, saying why should she think to thank him for that?
"Because you take care for my place," she'd said simply. but you don't try to take it from me." Then she'd taken the empty mug from him and gone back to the house. And once, in bed, and he flushed at the thought, with Claire standing right by him, he'd asked her why she liked Balriggan so much. It wasn't a family place, after all, nor remarkable in any way. And she'd sighed a little, pulled the quilt up to her chin, and said, "It's the first place I've felt safe." She wouldn't say more when he asked her, but only turned over and pretended to fall asleep. "She'd rather lose Joey than Balriggan," Joan was saying to Claire, "but she doesn't mean to lose him either. So you see the difficulty, aye?"
"I do, yes."
Claire was looking sympathetic, but shot him a glance indicating that this was, naturally, his problem.
"Of course it was," he thought, exasperated. "I'll do something," he said, not having the slightest notion what. But how could he refuse? God would probably strike him down for interfering with Joan's vocation, if his own sense of guilt didn't finish him off first.
"Oh, da, thank you." Joan's face broke into a sudden dazzling smile, and she threw herself into his arms. He barely got them up in time to catch her. She was a very solid young woman. But he folded her into the embrace he'd wanted to give her on meeting, and felt the odd pain ease as this strange daughter fitted herself tidily into an empty spot in his heart he hadn't known was there. The wind was still whipping by, and it might have been a speck of dust that made Claire's eyes glisten as she looked at him, smiling.
"Just the one thing," he said sternly, when Joan had released him and stood back.
"Anything," she said fervently.
"You'll pray for me, aye, when you're a nun."
"Every day," she assured him, "and twice on Sundays." The sun was starting down the sky by now, but there was still some time to supper.
I should, I suppose, be there to offer help with the meal preparations. These were both enormous and laborious, with so many people coming and going, and Lallybroch could no longer afford the luxury of a cook. But even if Jenny was taken up with nursing Ian, Maggie and her young daughters and the two housemaids were more than capable of managing. I would only be in the way. Or so I told myself, well aware that there was always work for a spare pair of hands. But I clambered down the stony hill behind Jamie and said nothing when he turned away from the trail to Lallybroch. We wandered down toward the little loch, well content.
"Perhaps I did have something to do with the books, aye?" Jamie said after a bit. "I mean, I read to the wee maids in the evenings now and again. They'd sit on the settle with me, one on each side with their heads against me, and it was..."
He broke off with a glance at me and coughed, evidently worried that I might be offended at the idea that he'd ever enjoyed a moment in Lyra's house. I smiled and took his arm. "I'm sure they loved it. But I really doubt that you read anything to Joan that made her want to become a nun."
"Aye, well," he said dubiously, "I did read to them out of the Lives of the Saints. Oh, and Fox's Book of the Martyrs, too, even though there's a good deal of it to do with Protestants. And Lyra said Protestants couldn't be martyrs because they were wicked heretics. And I said being a heretic didn't preclude being a martyr, and..."
He grinned suddenly. "I think that might have been the closest thing we had to a decent conversation."
"Poor Lyra," I said, "but putting her aside, and do let's, what do you think of Joan's quandary?" He shook his head dubiously.
"Well, I can maybe bribe Lyra to marry yon wee cripple, but it would take a deal of money, since she'd want more than she gets from me now. I haven't got that much left of the gold we brought, so it would need to wait until I can get back to the ridge and extract some more, take that to a bank, arrange for a draft. I hate to think of Joan having to spend a year at home trying to keep yon lust-crazed weasels apart."
"Lust-crazed weasels?" I said, entertained. "No, really. Did you see them at it?"
"Not exactly," he said, coughing. "You could see there was an attraction between them, though. Here, let's go along the shore.
I saw a curlew's nest the other day.
The wind had quieted, and the sun was bright and warm,
for the moment.
I could see clouds lurking over the horizon, and doubtless it would be raining again by nightfall. But for the moment it was a lovely spring day, and we were both disposed to enjoy it. By unspoken consent, we put aside all disagreeable matters and talked of nothing in particular, only enjoying each other's company, until we reached a shallow, grass-covered mound where we could perch and enjoy the sun. Jamie's mind seemed to return now and then to Lyra, though. I supposed he couldn't help it. I didn't really mind, as such comparisons as he made were entirely to my benefit.
Had she been my first, he said thoughtfully at one point, I think I might have had a much different opinion of women in general.
Well, you can't define all women in terms of what they're like or what one of them is like in bed, I objected. I've known men who, well...
Men? Was Frank not your first? He demanded, surprised.
I put a hand behind my head and regarded him. Would it matter if he wasn't?
Well,
clearly taken aback by the possibility, he groped for an answer.
I suppose.
He broke off and eyed me, meditatively stroking one finger down the bridge of his nose. One corner of his mouth turned up.
I don't know.
I didn't know myself. On the one hand, I rather enjoyed his shock at the notion. And at my age, I was not at all averse to feeling mildly wanton, if only in retrospect. On the other hand, well, where do you get off anyway, casting stones?
You were my first,
he pointed out with considerable asperity.
So you said, I said, teasing.
To my amusement, he flushed up like the rosy dawn.
You didn't believe me,
he said, his voice rising in spite of himself.
Well, you did seem rather well-informed for a so-called virgin,
to say nothing of imaginative.
For God's sake, Sassenach, I grew up on a farm. It's a very straightforward business after all.
He looked me closely up and down, his gaze lingering at certain points of particular interest.
And as for imagining things... Christ, I'd spent months, years, imagining.
A certain light filled his eyes, and I had the distinct impression that he hadn't stopped imagining in the intervening years, not by any means. What are you thinking? I asked, intrigued.
I'm thinking that the water in the loch's that wee bit chilly, but if it didn't a shrink my cock straight off, the feel of the heat when I plunged into you.
Of course, he added practically, eyeing me as though estimating the effort involved in forcing me into the loch.
We wouldn't need to do it in the water, unless you liked. I could just dunk you a few times, drag you onto the shore, and... God, your arse looks fine with the wet linen of your shift clinging to it. It goes all transparent, and I can see the weight of your buttocks like great smooth round melons.
I take it back. I don't want to know what you're thinking.
You asked, he pointed out logically. And I can see the sweet wee crease of your ass, too. And once I've got you pinned under me and you canna get away. Do you want it lying on your back, Sassenach, or bent over on your knees with me behind? I could take a good hold either way and...
I am not going into a freezing loch in order to gratify your perverted desires.
All right, he said, grinning.
Stretching himself out beside me, he reached round behind and took a generous handful.
You can gratify them here if you like, where it's warm.
Chapter 80. Enomancy. Lally Broch was a working farm. Nothing on a farm can stop for very long, even for grief. Which is how it came to be that I was the only person in the front of the house when the door opened in the middle of the afternoon. I heard the sound and poked my head out of Ian's study to see who had come in. A strange young man was standing in the foyer, gazing round appraisingly. He heard my step and turned, looking at me curiously. "Who are you?" we said simultaneously, and laughed.
"I'm Michael," he said, in a soft, husky voice with the trace of a French accent. "And you'll be Uncle Jamie's fairy woman, I suppose."
He was examining me with frank interest, and I felt therefore free to do the same. "Is that what the family's been calling me?" I asked, looking him over. He was a slight man, lacking either young Jamie's burly strength or young Ian's wiry height. Michael was Janet's twin, but didn't resemble her at all, either. This was a son who'd gone to France to become a junior partner in Jared Fraser's wine business, Fraser AC. As he took off his travelling cloak, I saw that he was dressed very fashionably for the Highlands, though his suit was sober in both colour and cut, and he wore a black crepe band around his upper arm.
"That, or the witch," he said, smiling faintly, "depending whether it's Da or Mam who's talking."
"Indeed," I said with an edge, but couldn't help smiling back. He was quiet, but an engaging young man, well, relatively young. He must be near 30, I thought. "I'm sorry for your loss," I said, with a nod toward the crepe band. "May I ask?"
"My wife," he said simply. "She died 2 weeks ago. I should have come sooner else."
That took me aback considerably. "Oh, I see. But your parents, your brothers and sisters, they don't know this yet." He shook his head and came forward a little, so the light from the fan-shaped window above the door fell on his face, and I saw the dark circles under his eyes and the marks of the bone-deep exhaustion that is grief's only consolation. "I am so sorry," I said, and, moved by impulse, put my arms around him. He leaned toward me under the same impulse. His body yielded for an instant to my touch, and there was an extraordinary moment in which I sensed the deep numbness within him, the unacknowledged war of acknowledgement and denial. He knew what had happened, what was happening, but couldn't feel it. Not yet. "Oh dear," I said, stepping back from the brief embrace. I touched his cheek lightly, and he stared at me, blinking.
"I will be damned," he said mildly. "They're right."
A door opened and closed above. I heard a foot on the stair, and an instant later, Lallybroch awoke to the knowledge that the last child had come home. The swirl of women and children wafted us into the kitchen, where the men appeared by ones and twos through the back door to embrace Michael or clap him on the shoulder. There were outpourings of sympathy, the same questions and answers repeated several times. How had Michael's wife, Lily, died? She had died of the influenza. So had her grandmother. No, he himself had not caught it. Her father sent his prayers and concerns for Michael's father. And eventually, the preparations for washing and supper and the putting of children to bed began, and Michael slipped out of the maelstrom. Coming out of the kitchen myself to fetch my shawl from the study, I saw him at the foot of the stair with Jenny, talking quietly. She touched his face, just as I had, asking him something in a low voice. He half-smiled, shook his head, and, squaring his shoulders, went upstairs alone to see Ian, who was feeling too poorly to come down to supper. Alone among the Murrays, Michael had inherited the fugitive gene for red hair and burned among his darker siblings like a coal. He had inherited an exact copy of his father's soft brown eyes, though. "And a good thing, too," Jenny said to me privately, "else his da would likely be sure I'd been at it wi' the goatherd, for God knows he doesn't look like anyone else in the family." I'd mentioned this to Jamie, who looked surprised, but then smiled.
"Aye, she wouldn't have ken it, for she never met Colum Mackenzie face to face."
"Colum, are you sure?" I looked over my shoulder.
"Oh, aye, the colouring's different, but allowing for age and good health. There was a painting at Leoch done of Colum when he was maybe 15, before his first fall. Recall it, do you? It hung in the solar on the third floor.
I closed my eyes, frowning in concentration, trying to reconstruct the floor plan of the castle.
"Walk me there," I said.
He made a small, amused noise in his throat, but took my hand, tracing a delicate line on my palm.
"Aye, here's the entrance with the big double door. You'd cross the courtyard once inside, and then..."
He walked me unerringly to the exact spot in my mind, and sure enough, there was a painting there of a young man with a thin, clever face and look of far-seeing in his eyes.
"Yes, I think you're right," I said, opening my eyes. "If he is as intelligent as Colum, then, I have to tell him."
Jamie's eyes, dark with thought, searched my face.
"We couldn't have changed things earlier," he said,
a note of warning in his voice.
"You likely cannot change what's to come in France."
"Maybe not," I said. "But what I knew..."
"What I told you before Culloden.
It didn't stop Charles Stuart, but you lived."
"Not on purpose," he said dryly.
"No, but your men lived too, and that was on purpose. So maybe, just maybe, it might help. And I can't live with myself if I don't." He nodded, sober.
"Aye, then. I'll call them."
The cork eased free with a soft pop, and Michael's face eased too. He sniffed the darkened cork, then passed the bottle delicately under his nose, eyes half-closing in appreciation.
"Well, what do you say, lad?" his father asked. "Will it poison us or no?"
He opened his eyes and gave his father a mildly dirty look.
"You said it was important, eh?"
"From Apulia," he added, with a note of satisfaction, and turned to me.
"Will that do, Aunt?"
Certainly, I said, taken back somewhat. "Why ask me? You're the wine expert." Michael glanced at me, surprised.
"Ian said," he began,
but stopped and smiled at me.
"My apologies, Aunt. I must have misunderstood."
Everyone turned and looked at young Ian, who reddened at this scrutiny.
"What exactly did you see, Ian?"
young Jamie asked. Young Ian narrowed his eyes at his brother, who seemed to be finding something funny in the situation.
"I said,"
young Ian replied, straightening himself defiantly,
"that Auntie Claire had something of importance to say to Michael, and that he must listen because she's a banshee," he said.
Michael ended helpfully. He didn't grin at me, but a deep humour glowed in his eyes, and for the first time I saw what Jamie had meant by comparing him to Colum McKenzie.
"I wasn't sure whether he meant that, Auntie, or if it's only you're a conjure woman, or a witch."
Jenny gasped at the word, and even the elder Ian blinked. Both of them turned and looked at young Ian, who hunched his shoulders defensively.
"Well, I dinna ken exactly what she is," he said. "But she's an old one, isn't she, Uncle Jamie?"
Something odd seemed to pass through the air of the room. A sudden live, fresh wind moaned down the chimney, exploding the banked fire and showering sparks and embers onto the hearth. Jenny got up with a small exclamation and beat them out with the broom. Jamie was sitting beside me. He took my hand and fixed Michael with a firm sort of look.
"There's no real word for what she is. But she has knowledge of things that will come to pass. Listen to her."
That settled them all to attention, and I cleared my throat, deeply embarrassed by my role as prophet, but obliged to speak nonetheless. For the first time, I had a sudden sense of kinship with some of the more reluctant Old Testament prophets. I thought I knew just what Jeremiah felt like when told to go and prophesy the destruction of Nineveh. I just hoped I'd get a better reception. I seem to recall that the inhabitants of Nineveh had thrown him into a well.
"You'll know more than I do about the politics in France," I said, looking directly at Michael.
"I can't tell you anything in terms of specific events for the next 10 or 15 years. But after that, things are going to go downhill fast. There's going to be a revolution. Inspired by the one that's happening now in America, but not the same. The king and queen will be imprisoned with their family, and both of them will be beheaded. A general gasp went up from the table, and Michael blinked. There will be a movement called the Terror, and people will be pulled out of their homes and denounced. All the aristocrats will either be killed or have to flee the country, and it won't be too good for rich people in general. Jared may be dead by then, but you won't be. And if you're half as talented as I think, you will be rich. He snorted a little at that, and there was a breath of laughter in the room, but it didn't last long. They'll build a machine called the guillotine. Perhaps it already exists, I don't know. It was originally made as a humane method of execution, I think, but it will be used so often that it will be a symbol of the Terror and of the revolution in general. You don't want to be in France when that happens.
How do you know this? Michael demanded.
He looked pale and half belligerent.
Well, here was the rub.
I took a firm grip of Jamie's hand under the table and told them how I knew. There was a dead silence. Only young Ian didn't look dumbfounded, but he knew already and more or less believed me. I could tell that most of those around the table didn't. At the same time, they couldn't really call me a liar.
That's what I know, I said, speaking straight to Michael, and that's how I know it.
You have a few years to get ready. Move the business to Spain or Portugal. Sell out and emigrate to America. Do anything you like, but don't stay in France for more than 10 years more.
That's all, I said abruptly.
I got up and went out, leaving utter silence in my wake. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was. I was in the hen coop collecting eggs when I heard the excited squawk and flutter of the hens outside that announced that someone had come into their yard. I fixed the last hen with a steely glare that dared her to peck me, snatched an egg out from under her, and came out to see who was there. It was Jenny, with an apron full of corn. That was odd. I knew the hens had already been fed, for I'd seen one of Maggie's daughters doing it an hour earlier. She nodded to me and tossed the corn in handfuls. I tucked the last warm egg into my basket and waited. Obviously, she wanted to talk to me and had made an excuse to do so in private. I had a deep feeling of foreboding. Entirely justified, too, for she dropped the last handful of cracked corn and, with it, all pretense. "I want to beg a favour," she said to me, but she avoided my eye, and I could see the pulse in her temple going like a ticking clock. "Jenny," I said, helpless either to stop her or to answer her. "I know." "Will you cure Ian?" she blurted, lifting her eyes to mine. I'd been right about what she meant to ask, but wrong about her emotion. Worry and fear lay behind her eyes, but there was no shyness, no embarrassment. She had the eyes of a hawk, and I knew she would rip my flesh like one if I denied her.
"Jenny," I said again, "I can't."
"You can't, or you won't," she said sharply.
"I can't. For God's sake, do you think I wouldn't have done it already if I had the power?"
"You might not, for the sake of the grudge you hold against me."
"If that's it, I'll say I'm sorry, and I do mean it, though I meant what I did for the best."
"You... what?"
I was honestly confused, but this seemed to anger her.
"Dinna pretend you've no notion what I mean. When you came back before and I sent for Lyra."
"Oh." I hadn't quite forgotten that, but it hadn't seemed important in light of everything else.
"That's all right. I don't hold it against you."
"Why did you send for her, though?" I asked, both out of curiosity and in hopes of diffusing the intensity of her emotion a little. I'd seen a great number of people on the ragged edge of exhaustion, grief, and terror, and she was firmly in the grip of all three. She made a jerky, impatient motion and seemed as though she would turn away, but didn't. "Jamie hadn't told you about her, nor her about you. I could see why, maybe, but I kent if I brought her here, he'd have nae choice then but to take the bull by the horns and clear up the matter." "She nearly cleared him up," I said, beginning to get somewhat hot myself. "She shot him, for God's sake!" "Well, I didn't give her the gun, did I?" she snapped. "I didn't mean him to see whatever he said to her, nor her to take up a pistol and put a ball in him."
"No, but you told me to go away."
"Why wouldn't I? You'd broken his heart once already, and I thought you'd do it again. And you with a nerve to come prancing back here, fine and blooming, when we'd been... It was that that gave Ian the cough."
"That? When they took him away and put him in the toll booth.
But you weren't here when that happened. You weren't here when we starved and froze and feared for the lives of our men and our bairns. Not for any of it. You were in France, warm and safe.
I was in Boston, 200 years from now, thinking Jamie was dead," I said coldly. "And I can't help Ian."
I struggled to subdue my own feelings, uncorked with a rush by this ripping of scabs off the past, and found compassion in the look of her, her fine-boned face gaunt and harrowed with worry, her hands clenched so hard that the nails bit into the flesh.
"Jenny," I said more quietly, "please believe me. If I could do anything for Ian, I'd give my soul to do it. But I'm not magic. I haven't any power. Only a little knowledge, and not enough." "I'd give my soul to do it," I repeated more strongly, leaning toward her. "But I can't. Jenny, I can't."
She stared at me in silence, a silence that lengthened past bearing, and finally I stepped around her and walked toward the house. She didn't turn around, and I didn't look back. But behind me, I heard her whisper,
"You have nae soul."
Chapter 81 Purgatory 2 When Ian felt well enough, he came out walking with Jamie, sometimes only as far as the yard or the barn, to lean on the fence and make remarks to Jenny's sheep. Sometimes he felt well enough to walk miles, which amazed and alarmed Jamie. Still, he thought, it was good to walk side by side through the moors and the forest and down beside the loch, not talking much, but side by side. It didn't matter that they walked slowly. They always had, since Ian had come back from France with a wooden leg. "I'm looking forward to having back my leg," Ian had remarked casually once, when they'd sat in the shelter of the big rock where Fergus had lost his hand, looking out over the small burn that ran down at the foot of the hill, watching for the stray flash of a leaping trout.
"Aye, that'll be good," Jamie had said, smiling a little.
And a little wry about it, too, recalling when he'd waked after Culloden and thought his own leg missing. He'd been upset and tried to comfort himself with the thought that he'd get it back eventually, if he made it out of purgatory and into heaven. Of course, he thought he was dead too, but that hadn't seemed nearly as bad as the imagined loss of his leg.
"I dinna suppose you'll have to wait," he said idly,
and Ian blinked at him.
"Wait for what?" "Your leg."
He realized suddenly that Ian had no notion what he'd been thinking, and hastened to explain.
"So I was only thinking, you wouldna spend much time in purgatory, if at all. So you'll have it back soon."
Ian grinned at him.
"What makes you so sure I will not spend 1,000 years in purgatory? I might be a terrible sinner, aye?" "Well, aye, you might be," Jamie admitted. "Though if so, you must think the devil of a lot of wicked thoughts, because if he'd been doing anything, I'd know about it." "Oh, you think so?"
Ian seemed to find this funny.
"You haven't seen me in years. I might have been doing anything, and you'd never ken a thing about it." "Of course I would," Jamie said logically. "Jenny would tell me. And you didn't mean to suggest she wouldn't ken if you had a mistress and 6 bastard bairns, or you'd taken to the highways and been robbing folk in a black silk mask?" "Well, possibly she would," Ian admitted. "Though, come on, man, there's nothing you could call a highway within 100 miles.
and had freezed to death long before I came across anyone worth robbing in one of the passes.
He paused, eyes narrowed against the wind, contemplating the criminal possibilities open to him.
I could have been stealing cattle, he offered. Though there's so few beasts these days, the whole parish would ken it at once should one go missing. And I doubt I could hide it amongst Jenny's sheep with any hope of its not being noticed.
He thought further, chin in hand, then reluctantly shook his head.
The sad truth is, Jamie, no one's had a thing worth stealing in the Highlands these 20 years past. Nay, theft's right out, I'm afraid. So is fornication, because Jenny would have killed me already. What does that leave? There's no really anything to covet. Suppose lying and murder is all that's left, and while I've met the odd man I would have liked to kill, I never did.
He shook his head regretfully, and Jamie laughed.
Why? You told me you killed men in France. Well, I did, but that was a matter of war. Or business, he added fairly. I was being paid to kill them. I didn't do it out of spite. Well, then, I'm right, Jamie pointed out. You'll sail straight through purgatory like a rising cloud. But I cannot think of a single lie you've ever told me.
Ian smiled with great affection.
Oh, well, I may have told lies now and then, Jamie, but no, not to you.
He looked down at the worn wooden peg stretched before him and scratched at the knee on that side.
I wonder, will it feel different?
How could it not?
Well, the thing is, Ian said, wriggling his sound foot to and fro, I can still feel my missing foot. Always have been able to, ever since it went. Not all the time, mind, he added, looking up, but I do feel it. A very strange thing. Do you feel your finger? He asked curiously, raising his chin at Jamie's right hand.
Well, I do. Not all the time, but now and then. And the nasty thing is that even though it's gone, it still hurts like damnation, which doesn't seem really fair.
He could have bitten his tongue at that, for here Ian was dying, and him complaining that the loss of his finger wasn't fair. Ian wheezed with amusement, though, and leaned back, shaking his head.
If life was fair, then what?
They sat in companionable silence for a while, watching the wind move through the pines on the hillside opposite. Then Jamie reached into his sporran and brought out the tiny, white-wrapped package. It was a bit grubby from being in his sporran, but had been tidily preserved and tightly wrapped. Ian eyed the little bundle in his palm.
What's this?
My finger, Jamie said. I wondered whether you'd maybe not mind to have it buried with you.
Ian looked at him for a moment, then his shoulders started to shake.
Oh, God, don't laugh, Jamie said, alarmed. I didn't mean to make you laugh. Christ, Jenny will kill me if you cough up a lung and die out here.
Ian was coughing, fits of it interspersed with long, drawn-out wheezes of laughter. Tears of mirth stood in his eyes, and he pressed both fists into his chest, struggling to breathe. At last, though, he left off and straightened slowly up, making a sound like a bellows. He sniffed deep and casually spat a glob of horrifying scarlet into the rocks.
I'd rather die out here laughing at you than in my bed with 6 priests saying prayers, he said. Doubt I'll get the chance, though.
He put out a hand, palm up.
Aye, give it here.
Jamie laid the little white-wrapped cylinder in his hand, and Ian tucked the finger casually into his own sporran.
I'll keep it safe till you catch me up.
He came down through the trees and made his way toward the edge of the moorland that lay below the cave. It was sharply cold, with a stiff breeze blowing, and the light changed over the land like the flicker of a bird's wings as the clouds slid overhead, long and fleeting. He'd picked up a deer trail through the heather earlier in the morning, but it had disappeared in a stony fall near a brae, and now he was coming back toward the house. He was behind the hill on which the broch stood, this side of it thick with a little wood of beech and pine. He'd not seen a deer or even a coney this morning, but wasn't bothered. With so many in the house, they could use a deer, to be sure. But he was happy only to be out of the house, even if he came back with nothing. He couldn't look at Ian without wanting to stare at his face, to commit him to memory, to impress these last bits of his brother-in-law upon his mind in the way that he recalled special vivid moments, there to be taken out and lived through again at need. But at the same time, he didn't want to remember Ian as he was now. Much better to keep what he had of him. Firelight on the side of Ian's face, laughing fit to burst as he'd forced Jamie's arm over in a wrestling match, his own wiry strength surprising them both. Ian's long, knob-jointed hands on the Gralloch knife, the wrench and the hot metal smell of the blood that seared his fingers, the look of his brown hair ruffling in the wind off the loch, the narrow back, bent and springy as a bow, as he stooped to snatch up one of his toddling bairns or grandchildren off their feet and throw them up, giggling, into the air. It was good they'd come, he thought. Better than good that they'd brought the lad back in time to speak to his father as a man, to comfort Ian's mind and take his leave properly. But to live in the same house with a beloved brother dying by inches under your nose wore sadly on the nerves. With so many women in the house, squabbling was inevitable. With so many of the women Frasers, it was like walking through a gunpowder mill with a lit candle. Everyone tried so hard to manage, to keep in countenance, to accommodate. But that only made it worse when some spark finally set the powder keg off. He wasn't only out hunting because they needed meat. He spared a sympathetic thought for Claire. After Jenny's anguished request, Claire had taken to hiding in their room, or in Ian's study. He had invited her to use it, and Jamie thought that aggravated Jenny still more, writing busily, making the book Andy Bell had put in her mind. She had great powers of concentration and could stay inside her mind for hours, but she had to come out to eat. And it was always there, the knowledge that Ian was dying, grinding like a quern, slow but relentless, wearing away the nerves. Ian's nerves, too. He and Ian had been walking, slowly, by the side of the loch 2 days before, when Ian stopped suddenly, curling in on himself like an autumn leaf. Jamie hurried to take him by the arm before he could fall, and he lowered him to the ground, finding a boulder to brace his back, pulling the shawl high around the wasted shoulders, looking for anything, anything at all he could do.
"What is it, Aharich?" he said, anxious, crouching beside his brother-in-law, his friend.
Ian was coughing almost silently, his body shaking with the force of it. At last the spasm eased, and he could draw breath, his face bright with a consumptive flush, that terrible illusion of health.
"It hurts, Jamie."
The words were spoken simply, but Ian's eyelids were closed as though he didn't want to look at Jamie while he spoke.
"I'll carry you back. We'll get you a bit of laudanum, maybe, and..."
Ian waved a hand, quelling his anxious promises. He breathed shallowly for a moment before shaking his head.
"Aye, my chest feels like there's a knife in it," he said finally. "But that's no what I meant. I'm no bothered so much about dying. But Christ, the slowness of it is killing me."
He did open his eyes then, meeting Jamie's, and laughed as silently as he'd coughed, the barest breath of sound as his body shook with it.
"This dying hurts me, Dougal. I'd have it over."
The words came into his mind as clearly as if they'd been spoken just now in front of him, rather than 30 years before in a dark church ruined by cannon fire. Rupert had said that, dying slow.
"You're my chief, man," he'd said to Dougal, imploring. "It's your job."
And Dougal Mackenzie had done what love and duty called for. He'd been holding Ian's hand, clasping hard, trying to force some notion of well-being from his own calloused palm into Ian's thin grey skin. His thumb slid upward now, pressing on the wrist where he'd seen Claire grip, searching out the truth of a patient's health. He felt the skin give, sliding across the bones of Ian's wrist. He thought suddenly of the blood vow given at his marriage, the sting of the blade, and Claire's cold wrist pressed to his, and the blood slick between them. Ian's wrist was cold too, but not from fear. He glanced at his own wrist, but there was no trace of a scar, either from vows or fetters. Those wounds were fleeting, long-healed.
"Do you remember when we gave each other blood for blood?"
Ian's eyes were closed, but he smiled. Jamie's hand tightened on the bony wrist, a little startled, but not truly surprised that Ian had reached into his mind and caught the echo of his thoughts.
"Aye, of course."
He couldn't help a small smile of his own, a painful one. They'd been 8 years old, the two of them. Jamie's mother and her bairn had died the day before. The house had been full of mourners, his father dazed with shock. They had slipped out, he and Ian, scrambling up the hill behind the house, trying not to look at the fresh-dug grave by the broch. Into the wood, safe under the trees. Had slowed then, wandering, come to a stop at last at the top of the high hill where some old stone building that they call the fort had fallen down long ago. They'd sat on the rubble, wrapped in their plaids against the wind, not talking much.
"I thought I'd have a new brother," he'd said suddenly, "but I don't. It's just Jenny and me still."
In the years since, he'd succeeded in forgetting that small pain, the loss of his hoped-for brother, the boy who might have given him back a little of his love for his older brother, Willie, dead of the smallpox. He'd cherished that pain for a little, a flimsy shield against the enormity of knowing his mother gone forever. Ian had sat thinking for a bit, then reached into his sporran and got out the wee knife his father had given him on his last birthday.
"I'll be your brother," he said, matter of fact,
and cut across his thumb, hissing a little through his teeth. He'd handed the knife to Jamie, who'd cut himself, surprised that it hurt so much. And then they'd pressed their thumbs together and sworn to be brothers always. And had been. He took a deep breath, bracing himself against the nearness of death, the black finality.
"Ian, shall I..."
Ian's eyelids lifted, the soft brown of his gaze sharpening into clarity at what he heard in the thickness of Jamie's voice. Jamie cleared his throat hard and looked away, then looked back, feeling obscurely that to look away was cowardly.
"Will you have me hasten you?" he asked very softly.
Even as he spoke, the cold part of his mind sought the way. Not by the blade, no. It was quick and clean, a proper man's departure. But it would cause his sister and the Waynes grief. Neither he nor Ian had the right to leave a final memory stained with blood. Ian's grip neither slackened nor clung, but of a sudden, Jamie felt the pulse he had looked for in vain, a small, steady throb against his own palm. He hadn't looked away, but his eyes blurred, and he bent his head to hide the tears.
Claire, she would know how, but he couldn't ask her to do it.
Her own vow kept her from it.
"No," Ian said. "Not yet, anyway."
He'd smiled, eyes soft.
"But I'm glad to ken you'll do it if I need you to. Mo bracha."
The flicker of a movement stopped him in his tracks and jerked him instantly from his thoughts. It hadn't seen him, though he was in sight. The wind was toward him, though, and the deer was busy nibbling among the crusts of dry heather for sheltered bits of grass and softer moor plants. He waited, listening to the wind. Only the deer's head and shoulders were visible behind a gorse bush, though he thought from the size of the neck that it was a male. He waited, feeling the way of it seep back into him. Hunting red deer on the moor was different from hunting in the forests of North Carolina. A slower thing altogether.
The deer moved out a little from behind the gorse bush, intent on its feeding, and he began, by imperceptible degrees, to raise his rifle. He'd had a gunsmith in Edinburgh straighten the barrel for him, but hadn't used it since. He hoped it would aim true. Hadn't used it since he'd clouted the Hessian with it in the redoubt. He had a sudden, vivid recollection of Claire dropping the misshapen bullet that had killed Simon into the china plate. Felt the chink and roll of it in his blood. Another step. Two. The deer had found something tasty and was tugging and chewing with great concentration. Like a thing completing itself, the muzzle of the rifle settled gently on its target. A big buck deer, and no more than 100 yards. He could feel the big, solid heart pumping under his own ribs, pulsing in the tips of his fingers on the metal. The stock snugged hard into the hollow of his shoulder. He was just beginning to squeeze the trigger when he heard the screams from the wood behind him. The gun went off, the shot went wild, the deer vanished with a crash of breaking heather, and the screams stopped. He turned and strode fast into the woods in the direction where he'd heard them, his heart pounding. Who? A woman? But who? He found Jenny without much difficulty, standing frozen in the small clearing where he and she and Ian came when they were young to share out stolen treats and play at knights and soldiers. She'd been a good soldier. Maybe she'd been waiting for him, having heard his gun. Maybe she just couldn't move. She stood straight-backed but empty-eyed and watched him come, her shawls wrapped like rusty armour around her. "Are you all right, lass?" he asked, setting down his rifle by the big pine where she'd read to him and Ian in the long summer nights when the sun barely set from dusk to dawn. "Aye, fine," she said, her voice colourless. "Aye, right," he said, sighing. Coming close, he insisted upon taking her hands in his. She didn't give them to him, but didn't resist. "I heard you scream." "I didn't mean anyone to hear."
"Of course you didn't."
He hesitated, wanting to ask again, was she all right, but that was foolish. He knew fine well what the trouble was, and why she needed to come and scream in the wood when no one would hear her and ask stupidly, was she all right?
"Do you want me to go away?" he asked instead.
And she grimaced, pulling at her hand, but he didn't let go.
"No. What difference does it make? What difference does anything make?"
He heard the note of hysteria in her voice.
"At least we brought the lad home in time," he said, for lack of anything else to offer her.
"Aye, you did," she said, with an effort at self-control that shredded like old silk.
"And you brought your wife back, too." "You blame me for bringing my wife?" he said, shocked. "Why, for God's sake? Should you not be happy she's come back? Or do you..."
He choked off the next words fast. He'd been about to demand whether she resented him still having a wife when she was about to lose her husband, and he couldn't say that. But that wasn't what Jenny had meant at all.
"Aye, she's come back. But for what?" she cried. "What good is a fairy woman too cold-hearted to lift a finger to save Ian?"
He was so staggered by this that he couldn't do anything but repeat, "Cold-hearted? Claire?" in a dazed fashion.
"I asked, and she denied me."
His sister's eyes were tearless, frantic with grief and urgency.
"Can you not make her help me, Jamie?"
The life in his sister, always bright and pulsing, thrummed under his fingers like chained lightning now. Better if she let it loose on him, he thought. She couldn't hurt him.
"Maupure, she'd heal him if she could," he said, as gently as possible, without letting go of her. "She told me you'd asked, and she wept in the telling. She loves Ian as much..." "Don't you dare be telling me she loves my husband as much as I do," she shouted, jerking her hands out of his with such violence that he was sure she meant to strike him. She did, slapping his face so hard that his eye watered on that side. I wasn't going to tell you that at all, he said, keeping his temper.
He touched the side of his face gingerly.
I was going to say that she loves him as much.
He'd intended to say,
as she loves me,
but didn't get that far. She kicked him in the shin hard enough to buckle his leg, and he stumbled, flailing to keep his balance, which gave her the opportunity to turn and fly down the hill like a witch on a broomstick, her skirts and shawls whirling out like a storm around her. Chapter 82 Dispositions. Cleansing of wounds, I wrote carefully, and paused, marshalling my thoughts. Boiling water, clean rags, removal of foreign matter, use of maggots on dead flesh, with a note of caution regarding blowfly and screwworm larva. No, pointless. No one would be able to tell the difference without a magnifying glass. The stitching of wounds, sterilization of needle and thread, useful poultices. Ought I to put in a separate section on the production and uses of penicillin? I tapped the quill on the blotter, making tiny stars of ink, but finally decided against it. This was meant to be a useful guide for the common person. A common person wasn't equipped for the painstaking process of making penicillin, nor yet likely to have an injection apparatus. Though I did think briefly of the penis syringe Dr. Fentiman had shown me, with a faint twinge of amusement. That, in turn, made me think briefly, but vividly, of David Rawlings and his jugum penis. Did he really use it himself? I wondered, but hastily dismissed the vision conjured up by the thought and flipped over a few sheets looking for my list of main topics. Masturbation, I wrote thoughtfully. If some doctors discussed it in a negative light, and they most certainly did, I suppose there was no reason why I shouldn't give the opposing view, discreetly. I found myself still making inky stars a few moments later, thoroughly distracted by the problem of talking discreetly about the benefits of masturbation. God, what if I said in print that women did it? They'd burn the whole printing, and likely Andy Bell's shop too, I said aloud. There was a sharp intake of breath, and I glanced up to see a woman standing in the door of the study. Oh, are you looking for Ian Murray? I said, pushing back from the desk. He's... No. It's you I was looking for. There was a very odd tone to her voice, and I stood up, feeling suddenly defensive without knowing why. Ah, I said, and you are... She stepped out of the shadowed hall into the light. You'll not know me then? Her mouth twitched in an angry half-smile. Lyra Mackenzie... Fraser, she added, almost reluctantly. Oh, I said. I would have recognized her at once, I thought, save for the incongruity of context. This was the last place I would have expected her to be, and the fact that she was here. A recollection of what had happened the last time she had come to Lallybroch made me reach inconspicuously for the letter opener on the desk. You were looking for me, I repeated warily. Not Jamie.